Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip.
Maintaining our leadership in research and technology is crucial to America's success. But if we want to win the future, if we want innovation to produce jobs in America and not overseas, then we also have to win the race to educate our kids. We need to teach our kids that it's not just the winner of the Super Bowl who deserves to be celebrated, but the winner of the science fair.
President Obama used a major part of his State of the Union address to focus on science and the importance of science education to the future of America in today's global economy. Today on Route 51, we have two local guests who are way ahead of that curve, two UW-Stevens Point chemistry professors involved in cutting-edge research who are also educating the next generation of scientists. I'm Glenn Moberg. One of our guests is John Drusky, a pioneer in research into the use of polymers to slow the aging process of NASA spacesuits and also for use in healing fractured bones in the human body. Nate Bowling is synthesizing new organic molecules for possible use in the next generation of electronic devices such as solar cells and light-emitting diodes. And the UW-Stevens Point Chemistry Lab is getting the tools it needs to stay on the cutting edge. The lab was recently awarded a grant to acquire a high-resolution QTOF mass spectrometer to guide faculty research projects and to share that knowledge with its students. Today, we will go into detail with John Drusky and Nate Bowling on the work they're doing at the school and what it could mean for our lives in the future. We will also talk about scientific research, science education, and what some are calling the abysmal state of science literacy in America's adult population and in our students. Now, as always, we want to hear from you. If you've got a question for either Professor Drusky or Professor Bowling, and you'd like to weigh in on the topic of science research and education, give us a phone call at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Our lines are wide open. Your reaction, gentlemen, to the concept that we as a society should celebrate the winners of science fairs in the same way that we celebrate the winner of the Super Bowl?
Well, I think we're hoping that there'll be winners of both. We're certainly hoping for the Super Bowl. But I think the point is well made that in today's emerging and changing economies and how we will address those things in the coming years that we really need to look at promoting science. Our new technologies are going to likely are to be the basis of growing economies in the foreseeable future. And one way to do that is to encourage young people to get involved through their science fairs.
Nate Bowling, your reaction to that comment?
I think it's important to have a target, something enthusiastic. You see the MVP of the Super Bowl holding up the trophy, and this kid can say, I want to be that person. I want to be in that moment. It's harder to identify that with science, and I think we need to identify a problem that needs to be solved. The president pointed to the Sputnik era.
Yeah.
And I think the same can be said now. We need to identify a scientific problem that a student can say, I want to, you know, a third grader or fourth grader can say, I want to be the person that solves that problem.
You know, traditionally we have had the winners of the Super Bowl at the White House. And this president has followed up on his push for science education because he has had the winners of science fairs visiting the White House, too, which is a bit of a departure from prior administrations. Is it hard to attract students into the chemistry program at UW-Stevens Point or to get students interested in pursuing chemistry and advanced degrees in physics and the other hard sciences?
Well, I'm not sure we want to call them hard sciences, but certainly the physical sciences, and they are challenging in their way. But I also think they're very rewarding, and I think our students pick up on that, certainly by the involvement, say, in research projects that we have, and they talk to other students, and they, whether it be through their courses, get excited in learning about some topic, or by talking with students and finding out that they're excited about being involved in a research project, and especially when they can come to realize that they could be involved as well. So we have a strong chemistry program, and we're happy with the number of majors that we have.
I guess what I'm saying is generally speaking, are enough students, and let's go to the high school level, are enough of our students, a big enough percentage, interested in pursuing careers in science as opposed to careers in business or careers in marketing or careers in all of the other different things that you can do?
I would say, to answer your previous question, and hopefully I'll get around to that question, the students that come through the door to come to us, it's easy to get them into scientific careers. We get them involved in our research projects. We get them in our classrooms. It's really easy to get them enthusiastic. We need to see those numbers increase of the students that do walk through our doors, to get them in those careers. And I think that happens at a young age. Students develop an interest in science or whatever they develop an interest in. In our department, and a lot of universities do this, we do a lot of outreach. A lot of people in our department do a lot of outreach where they go to schools, do demonstrations, and try to get them interested in science. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a big push in our department, and I think a lot of other people should get involved in that as well.
Well, you remember all of the, the Mr. Wizard demonstrations where the guy would bring the Van de Graaff generator and mix chemicals together and do the explosions. And, that's entertaining, but doing real science takes a lot of work and a lot of dedication and a lot of hours.
Mm-hmm.
A recent report ranked U.S. teens 29th worldwide in science, behind all of the major industrial countries and even behind countries like Croatia, the Czech Republic, and Liechtenstein. And for what it's worth, Finland is at the top of the 57 countries that were ranked. Do studies like that and statistics like that give you gentlemen pause?
There certainly are concerns. And we're as chemistry faculty, I think we just represent maybe a part of that that entire area of science, and the concerns about science spanning so many grade levels before college all the way through college. I think we'd have to ask, how are those numbers being determined? What are they measuring? We do hear people say that in the United States, creativity is very much encouraged, and that can be a very important component of science. And a matter of, looking at what exactly is being measured and are the measurables things that are really what's most important about becoming a scientist or succeeding.
Nate, what do you think?
I really think it goes back to enthusiasm for science, getting people excited about science. My experience in my 5 years, and I think John's experience, is that the students that we encounter are perfectly capable of doing the science and the math. It's just getting those people involved early. If you're in high school, once you get to high school, sometimes you have a choice which classes to take, which if you take the math sciences or math courses and science courses. And if they choose not to take those, I think that's a failing on our part in not getting them enthusiastic, not letting them understand what these careers are about, what these fields are about.
Is there maybe too much choice? Should we be forcing our kids in elementary schools and in our high schools to at least have some kind of a cursory knowledge of important scientific concepts?
Well, we'd certainly, I don't mean to speak for Nate, I'll let him speak for himself, but I think we certainly would welcome more science. That's an easy one. I think to just wonder, as you think about it, what really would encourage those numbers or what would make those scores go up? And I wonder if it's just a matter of more courses, more emphasis on it, or is there a whole array of questions that give rise to those test scores?
Nate, what do you think? Do we need more science, maybe even more required courses in science at the elementary level and the high school level?
The scientist in me says yes. The human in me says it would be much nicer for people to want to take those science courses, to get to those kids early, that they were excited about the science. And so we weren't twisting their arm to take the science, but we're having trouble staffing the classes we need to because there's so much demand for students wanting to take science. I think that would be my ultimate kind of dream for high school science, is we'd have so much demand for those courses that we'd have to add additional staff to teach those.
Let's listen to another clip from the President's State of the Union address.
We will move forward together, or not at all. A half a century ago, when the Soviets beat us into space with the launch of a satellite called Sputnik, We had no idea how we would beat them to the moon. The science wasn't even there yet. NASA didn't exist. But after investing in better research and education, we didn't just surpass the Soviets. We unleashed a wave of innovation that created new industries and millions of new jobs. This is our generation's Sputnik moment. 2 years ago, I said that we needed to reach a level of research and development we haven't seen since the height of the space race. And in a few weeks, I will be sending a budget to Congress that helps us meet that goal. We'll invest in biomedical research, information technology, and especially clean energy technology. Now, clean energy breakthroughs will only translate into clean energy jobs if businesses know there will be a market for what they're selling. So tonight, I challenge you to join me in setting a new goal. By 2035, 80% of America's electricity will come from clean energy sources.
This is America's Sputnik moment. Now, I was 6 years old when Sputnik was launched. I think it was 1958. John, I don't know if you're old enough to even have a childhood memory of that. I know that Nate isn't.
Well, I was a little bit younger, but in that same ballpark.
React to that comment. Now, at the time, we were all motivated for scientific research and for pushing ahead because we were in the midst of the Cold War with the Soviet Union, and that little ball circling above the Earth was threatening in a lot of ways. And we were reacting out of fear. Is there the same kind of imperative to push ahead with scientific research? Because maybe the fear right now isn't another Soviet Union, but the fear that we'll be buried in a world economy if we don't have the resources that we need to compete.
I think it's a fair question. I remember that time. You had said 58. I was 4 at the time. And I don't remember exactly then, but maybe in the next 10 years after that, I don't remember being afraid as much, although there certainly were some things. We had these drills where you went under a desk.
Duck and cover.
Right. But I also remember a tremendous excitement and enthusiasm that science somehow could provide some real solutions. And I think maybe going back to the question we had before about what happens with regards to training before the university time, that the most important thing I think if we could have students come to us really enthusiastic about science, and really I'm not so sure the concern is the content, but that they want to study science and that they see it as something that could provide solutions.
I remember in my elementary school when they sent Alan Shepard up on that first Mercury spacecraft launch. They got the entire school into the school gymnasium. We had a little flickering black and white TV. They preempted all of the programming on all of the major networks, all three of them at the time. And I remember watching that and amazed as a young boy about what was becoming possible. Now we seem to take a lot of that stuff for granted. We've got that space station up above us. We have people from all over the world in the space station continually. Amazing stuff is happening. There is a cable channel, the NASA channel, devoted 24 hours, 7 days a week to it. But we seem to take it for granted and maybe not appreciate it the way we should.
Yeah, I think you're talking about the fear of kind of being buried in the world economy earlier. I think that's kind of an abstract fear for young people to have. Having that goal, that target, like you said, it's become kind of mundane space travel. It's not really celebrated as much. I think something else to focus our attention on. The president's kind of pinpointed solar energy as one of those things. And from a scientific level, that there's so many challenges to solar energy that just the pursuit of that, this pursuit of that process, we have so many technological developments along the way. And I think that was what the president was alluding to as far as the discoveries in the Sputnik era creating millions of jobs, is in order to solve all those problems of how to, a manned mission to the moon, there were so many technological developments that needed to be made. And I think that's what we need to do, is set a really high goal And along the way, we're going to have a lot of technological development, and that's ultimately going to create a lot of new jobs, a new economy.
And that solar energy, of course, if we do the breakthroughs in order to get solar energy to the point where it's really providing a significant amount of our electrical power in this country, well, you know, that does have a national security implication, because we're cutting the ties to foreign oil in that process. So there is a national security component to this, similar to Sputnik. We're talking to John Drusky and Nate Bowling, two UW Stevens Point chemistry professors who are doing cutting-edge research, and we're going to get into that research in detail. Some of the things that Nate is doing in particular with synthesizing organic molecules, it does have some implications for solar energy and for nanotechnology and some of the things that the president was talking in the State of the Union address. We want to hear from you. What do you think about the state of science in America? Are we emphasizing scientific research enough? Can we afford to do what the president wants to do given the budget constraints and the huge size of our deficit? Or is it something that we can't afford not to do? 1-800-780-9742. 1-800-780-9742. Our lines are wide open right now. You can get right in. I'm Glenn Mulbrick. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network.
Support for WPR comes from UMR, a United Healthcare company providing employee benefits administration, integrated health management, and pharmacy benefits administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More at umr.com.
I'm Glenn Mulbrick. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. We're talking about the importance of scientific research and the specific scientific research of our guests, John Drusky and Nate Bowling of UW Stevens Point, specifically of the chemistry department. Nate, why don't we start with you, since we were talking about the importance of solar energy and advances in photovoltaics. Give me an idea of what you're doing and how synthesizing organic chemicals might have implications for that field.
Okay, sure. In any kind of electronic device, it's got to be made of some kind of material. And historically, wires, have copper and things like that in them. Solar materials are no different. They're got to be made of some material. And sometimes when you look at a problem in technology, a material, you look at that and say, you know what, we don't really have the building blocks to make that material. We don't have any chemicals that we know of that have those properties. So what you do is you go back in the lab and you try to make those from scratch, from molecules that are available commercially. So we buy simple molecules and we stitch them together, just like a builder would build a house, and we see what the properties of those molecules are.
And the implications of that for things like solar cells and light-emitting diodes?
The idea is we're not just making molecules just for the sake of making molecules. Is we look at the properties that we would want out of a solar cell or a light-emitting diode, and we make molecules that we think will have those properties. It's kind of, you make the molecule, you see if you have the property. If not, you tweak it, you go back and make a different molecule.
Are you really making molecules that have never existed before on the Earth?
Yeah, one thing that I think that one message I try to get across to my students real early is when they go into the research lab, every day, every week, they're making something that no one else has made before. The ideas they're working on are things that no one has thought about before, possibly. So these molecules, some of my students that graduate, they'll graduate and they've made 20, 30 molecules that no one else has ever made before. So they have total ownership of that molecule.
Well, if you can't get people excited about something like that, you're not alive, John, give us a thumbnail sketch of what you're doing. We have to be kind of brief because we're heading into a news break, and we'll get into things in more detail in the second half of the show.
Most of the research that my students are involved in these days focuses on trying to look at polymeric materials as bioresorbable materials. So we're doing a collaboration with the Marshfield Clinic to see if these at some point might be even, useful in treating maybe an infection as a way to deliver antibiotics more effectively than the way they're being used now. There's a whole array of applications, including even in environmental applications, where they might be used in sustainable type applications.
With polymers?
Mm-hmm.
Treating infections, how does that work?
Well, it would be just as a way to maybe implant the antibiotic in a way where, it, as it biodegrades, it delivers the medicine in a controlled way.
Have you had success so far with medical applications, or is this something that that you're working on perfecting right now?
Right now we're at the preparation of the materials stage. As Nate was saying, students get to make molecules that haven't been here before, and they're very excited about that. And as we make these in the laboratory, we're learning more about their properties, and they seem to be good candidates for that.
You've got a lot of interesting stuff happening at UW-Stevens Point right now. A lot of research going on, not just in the chemistry department, but in the other sciences as well.
Certainly.
Anything that really stands out for you?
There are people at Stevens Point that are working in biofuels, trying to look at ways to prepare fuels from sources other than petroleum. We have people in our own department that are doing nanotechnology research, also biochemical research, working with inorganic materials, a whole array of different types of research happening on campus.
Okay. We're going to get into that in more detail with our guests, John Drusky and Nate Bowling of the UW-Stevens Point Chemistry Department. We're also talking about the importance of science, the abysmal state of science literacy among American adults and students, the president's call to America for more scientific research and science education, the need for a Sputnik moment to make us more competitive on the world stage, the need to emphasize green technology and green energy. What do you think? 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. We'll be back after this break for news. We're back on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio talking about the importance of science, scientific research, America's Sputnik moment, the importance of science education, and the work of our two specific guests, specific scientists, Nate Bowling and John Drusky, who are with the UW-Stevens Point Chemistry Department. John is working on new advances in polymers, and Nate is working on advances in synthesizing organic molecules, which has implications for green technology, photovoltaics, and nanotechnology. We want to hear from you. 1-800-780-9742. The lines are wide open. Do you really think that Americans are scientifically illiterate, which is what the surveys say, that students are scientifically illiterate, that we need to really increase our support of the sciences? Can we afford to spend a lot of money on scientific research? Do you think the president was right when he said that we are facing a Sputnik moment with this country? And if not, why not? Do you think we can even afford it? 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Nate, talk about these organic molecules that you are synthesizing and the implications for nanotechnology. We hear a lot about that phrase and how it's going to be the key to an awful lot of what we're doing right now.
Mm-hmm. My research specifically is about organic molecules, organic structures, which has slightly different meaning in chemistry terms than it does in popular culture, but it's roughly the same thing. Organic molecules mostly means they're things made out of carbon, so natural things. One real goal, a lot of electronic devices typically are made out of metals, which are not renewable and expensive, hard to mine. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the target of current science is to make those types of materials, those electronic devices, out of organic materials, renewable resources. So to take carbon-based things and make them have interesting electronic properties, either semiconductors or conductors, things that could replace metals, so we'd have this renewable source of electricity.
Where would you get the raw materials for those
for those molecules?
There's two answers. The answer right now, the current answer, is most chemicals we use in our laboratories come from petroleum, and those are distilled, and people make them into different, more complicated chemicals, and chemical companies sell those to us. One real push in science is to get those molecules, those organic sources, from renewable resources, so from bio-based molecules. And that's a real push, and I think it's something that can really people should get excited about, is using John mentioned biofuels earlier, not only getting our energy from bio-renewable things, but the materials we use, getting those from renewable resources.
And, of course, if we get them from the renewable resources, that's you're not only pushing research that has implications for renewable resources and green energy, but the very process of generating the molecules in the first place is being done in a green way. Yeah. Does all of this fit into UW-Stevens Point's traditional emphasis on environmental education? It seems to.
I think it's science. In the science world, this is kind of where the push is going to, and I think our campus has done a good job of identifying that push early to be a green campus. I think our campus is kind of taking a lead in the state and being a green campus and trying to use renewable resources. I think that's right in step with where the scientific world is. The scientific world has identified this as an issue and something we really need to address, that we get our materials and energy as much as possible from renewable resources.
The polymers that you're working with, what are the sources of those molecules?
Right now they'd be primarily petroleum-based, but in fact that's one of the focuses of our research, is to try to make them in a sustainable way. And we believe that the synthetic tools are there, and over time we should be able to make them from agricultural products. And in fact that's an important part of what we're trying to do, is to see if we're able to do that.
Your chemistry lab recently got this grant within the last year or so for this mass spectrometer. It's like how much does the thing cost?
Well, it's just about $500,000.
$500,000. What is it? What does it do? And why do you need it?
Well, it's an instrument that allows us to determine something about the structure of a molecule. Particularly by measuring its mass. And the main purpose, the reason that we got it, actually applies in a number of different research projects, but one of the main reasons was to look at biochemical processes, where you can actually look at maybe how a plant may flower, and what are the chemical changes that are happening before and after that event.
How do you do that with this machine?
Well, it's not actually in my specific area, but my understanding of it is that it's really detective work, that you analyze what's there before and you analyze again what's there afterwards and try to look for new molecules and then try to determine what they are.
How many schools in the Midwest have a machine like this?
I would say it's probably not very common at the four-year institutions, but I have no data for that.
Nate, is this mass spectrometer valuable to your work, or is it something other departments are doing?
It certainly is, and I think it's valuable for John's work and my work and the biochemistry work that's going on in our department. As you can imagine, with a molecule, you can't see it by any means, so there's got to be specialized instruments to identify the molecules you're making. When we go to make molecules that we think are going to have properties that would be suitable for solar energy and things like that, we have a target molecule, a structure in mind, but we can't. Once we make it, how do we prove that's what we actually made? So we need this specialized technology to prove those are the molecules that we're making. It really lets us identify what the molecule is. And from a biochemical standpoint, you can think of the proteins in the body. A mouse with a disease and without a disease, and you see what proteins are in its body that are associated with that disease, and that has huge implications for medicine, and we have people in our department doing that type of research.
Well, you would need something like that to discover whether or not you'd actually synthesize the right molecule, because you can't look at it under a magnifying glass.
Exactly.
Huh. And again, what you said in the first half of the show, your students are creating molecules that have never existed before on the planet Earth.
Yeah, I would say on a daily basis, a weekly basis.
You would think everything's been created that could be created.
That was certainly the impression I had coming through high school and even into college. And when I took organic chemistry in college, I just realized that was when it struck me, the diversity of structures, that there's an endless number of organic structures that can be made, an endless number of molecules that can be made. So there is no end in sight. There is no point where we're going to get to where every molecule has been made. There's no such thing as every molecule. There's countless number of structures that can be made.
This is going to sound really off the wall, but I'm sure some people are thinking about it. If you were to take this far enough, could this be the kind of thing where you could actually create molecules like amino acids that are the precursors to life?
People artificially synthesize those things all the time. It's pretty common. Biomolecules are molecules. They're made out of the same things that we use in our lab every day. It's just a matter of how you stitch them together, and the complexity of the body is such that doing that would be very, very difficult. But what those molecules are made of are the same things. It's just a matter of doing the chemistry.
Hey, has anybody ever gotten even close to the point where you create an amino acid or a molecule that's capable of replicating itself?
Boy, that's far removed from the things that Nate and I do. That. So we're going to leave that to but others.
Leave that to the science fiction
community. But Glenn, you had asked before about drawing people to science and how that really works and how we feel. What is it that attracts students? And what Nate was just describing is exactly what draws students. That feeling of the excitement, and I think tapping into what people care about. And you had mentioned our environmental emphasis at UWSP. We have a very long tradition in that, and students really I think across the country care very much about the environment, and to be involved in a project that has that sense of newness and excitement, but also taps into the things they really care about, like the environment or like biomedical research. It becomes a pretty easy to convince them to continue in that area.
John, let's talk a little bit about your research with polymers. One of the things that you're doing, which kind of struck me, is finding a way to make NASA spacesuits last longer without disintegrating. Explain that.
Well, that's not exactly what we're doing, but it's certainly
Then I didn't read the press
well,
release.
No, it's close enough. We were involved. First of all, I would just explain that polymers exist as both natural or synthetic materials. So many of the things that we're aware of, our skin and our hair and so on, are natural polymers. And then there's a whole many different synthetic materials, and I think most of us are familiar with those, with the polymers and that would be like plastics and rubber and so on. In fact, those materials were made to really replicate what nature had already given to mm-hmm. us. So the work there with the spacesuits really came from the Smithsonian Institution. I had worked with the materials advisory group. You had mentioned earlier the Sputnik era. Those spacesuits are falling apart, and they're such a national treasure that it's a real travesty to see that happen. And so what we're trying to do, what we were involved with, was trying to characterize what was happening and if there were some ways to slow it down.
And explain specifically how your research into polymers is doing that.
Well, many of the materials in spacesuits are very very advanced, literally space age materials. The outer coating is very important, that it be resistant to flame and high temperatures, plus all the environmental issues, the various places that they will be used, not always a very friendly environment. But then there's also a lot of, and those components, by the way, would be, say Teflon over glass, mm-hmm. Fibers. But then you also have components like a rubber bladder inside. And again, the spacesuit's an old spacesuit versus a modern spacesuit. Of course, the technology has changed over time. But the rubber bladder inside just does not last very long. There's also polyvinyl chloride components, and both of those readily degrade, and it's really a problem.
So are you actually going to use some of your materials to replace these degrading materials in the old spacesuits, or is this something to use in spacesuits that are not yet being manufactured?
Well, that
you know, is there a way of trying to preserve these old historic suits that you say are falling apart?
My thought when I first went to the Smithsonian was this shouldn't be so hard. We ought to be able to replace it with something else, as you just suggested. But there's a strong desire to not change the suits. These have tremendous historic value. And
it's like touching up the Mona Lisa.
Right. So when you think 200 years from now, someone's going to be interested in what was used. And sometimes the documentation changes over time, and being able to actually analyze the materials themselves in an unmodified form is very important. So it's more desirable to have them not degrade than it is to, say, put a coating over them or do something that would change them and significantly.
We're talking to John Drusky and Nate Bowling, two UW Stevens Point chemistry professors who are involved in cutting-edge research and are also educating the next generation of scientists. We are having this discussion in the context of President Obama's call for more scientific research, more scientific education, saying that America faces a Sputnik moment. 1-800-780-9742. If you'd like to join the conversation, I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio.
The businesses, professionals, and organizations that support Wisconsin Public Radio's programming play an important part in our financial health. When you visit a WPR sponsor, please let them know that you appreciate their support of this station. Thanks very much.
1-800-780-9742 if you want to join the conversation. And, gentlemen, I want to get back to scientific literacy for just a couple of minutes. American adults are also very bad at science, according to some of these polls that have been taken. According to a national survey commissioned by the California Academy of Sciences and the Harris polls, the U.S. public is unable to pass even a basic scientific literacy test. Only 53% know how long it takes for the Earth to revolve around the sun. 53%. Only 59% know that the earliest humans and dinosaurs did not live at the same time. So that 41% apparently are the folks who think that the Flintstones is a documentary. And only 47% can roughly approximate the percent of the Earth's surface that is covered with water, which is about 70%. We live in a scientifically advanced, technologically advanced society. We have the internet that is spewing out all of this information. It's all accessible to us, but yet people don't even have the most cursory understanding of basic scientific facts.
I think if we look at, we had mentioned before about the economy, jobs, what does the next 10 years look like? Of course, no one has a crystal ball. But certainly innovation and scientific discovery plays a very important role in that. It would seem that the current state of affairs, if people say, whether it be voting or other sorts of things that we're all involved in, if we don't at least promote getting to the point where we understand some of these things that affect all of us, it's very important. On the other hand, we all know we're very busy. We're all keeping track of things as best we can. But I think we do need to, as the president called for in the State of the Union address, that we need to try to promote that as much as possible.
Nate, do you have anything to add? Or
I think funding is important. I mean, money, increasing research, getting interesting research projects, but money also for outreach, allowing people to go out and spread the word about science to you know, people in the communities, or maybe even just in the schools. You know, maybe if we're kind of embarrassed about the state of our science literacy now, maybe that's a cautionary tale for the future. Instead of, you know, like John said, people are busy, people have other concerns. It's going to be hard to generate science literacy, you know, among adults that have jobs and mortgages and things like that. But perhaps you can reach the kids, and it's going to take money to get that message across.
You know, sometimes I get the feeling that we have too much information with the internet and with all of these possible sources. You're just inundated in it. You know, in the old days we had three television networks. Now we have hundreds of them, and we have 24-hour, 7-day-a-week cable television networks that, you know, they're not always dedicated to telling the truth about things at all times. We have all this information coming out, and yet in a lot of the information that you see on the internet, a lot of it is simply spreading statements about science that either isn't true, or they're trying to get you to believe it's not true because it doesn't fit the political needs of the people who are spreading the information. The idea, for instance, that climate change isn't occurring. Fewer and fewer people believe that all the time, unless you're a scientist, of course. You run into people who believe that the Earth is only 6,000 years old, people who don't believe in evolution. And you see that stuff on the Internet being passed off as if it's the truth, and yet it is the basis for everything in the science of biology. So, the statement that I think of a lot of times in journalism is you're entitled to your own opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts. So maybe we in the media are doing a poor job of separating fiction from reality and fact from opinion.
I think part of it has to do with critical thinking is being able to look at data and say, is that a credible piece of data? Is that a credible fact? And digging in a little further. And I think the university as a whole, even beyond just the science, that's what the university is about, is establishing critical thinkers. People were able to take in information and have student and be able and make judgments based on that, sound judgments. We know if you look at the internet and believe everything you read on the internet, then your mind's going to be filled with some good stuff and some garbage.
And yet it's an incredible tool. You know, it makes my job researching material so much easier. But you have to take it all with a grain of salt. You have to double check it.
Yeah, I'm never going to advocate less information. It's just being able to plow through that information and being critical of each piece of information. Is this credible or is this not credible?
When students get to places like UW-Stevens Point and they enroll in your chemistry courses, they're already pretty capable of doing critical thinking. What do we need to do at the elementary school level and the high school level in order to foster those kinds of abilities in a broader spectrum of people at an earlier age?
I think students in general are wonderfully curious and excited about learning about new things. As you had mentioned, we try to move from just an avalanche of information, and how do we move that more and more into knowledge? And maybe as we look at the different grade levels, we have to make sure it's grade level appropriate. Something that is addressed in a very early grade is going to be very different than later on. But I think the key is to make sure that people remain, as Nate said, thinking about things in a critical way, learning to weigh both sides of an issue, and to stay enthusiastic, or to learn to be enthusiastic about the things that matter to them.
How do you rate the science programs in the UW system compared to the rest of the nation, other state university systems? We're right up there, aren't we?
Again, it's a little difficult to answer that with data, but we're certainly very proud of our UW system, and I think we do have feedback that we get that tells us that our students go on to do great things, and we're really proud of the things they do. So I think that speaks for a strong educational system.
John Drusky, Nate Bowling, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Glenn.
Thank you.
We want to thank our guests, John Drusky and Nate Bowling, professors of chemistry at UW-Stevens Point.
Undulation is steady coming through. Your molecular structure, baby, me and you. Your cellular organization is really something choice. Electromagnetism about to make me lose my voice. Got all my circuits open, my system's reading go. Your cellular organization, baby, stop the show.
I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music tonight by Mose Allison. Next Thursday on Route 51, we take a trip to the theater as we preview an ambitious project involving four different high schools in central Wisconsin, The Phantom of the Opera. Reminder, you can follow our adventures on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks again for riding along with us today. Until next week, we're heading out of town.
Molecular structure, it really something swell. A high frequency modulated decibel. Thermodynamically, you're getting to me. Your molecular structure, baby. Ooh-wee.